Radio.
The God of Surprises. Father Gerard Kelly reflects on his life. This talk is from the 5th Credo Colloquium entitled The Power of the Message, the Kerygma for the New Evangelization.
So we're getting towards the end of a long day, so I don't feel that I wish to keep you too long. I'm going to tell you some stories from my life, and I've thought of 5 chapters. The first chapter's not true, but it captures some truth. The second chapter's called I'm Here Against Doctor's Orders. The third chapter's called My First Love. The fourth chapter is called The Most Important Day of My Life. And the fifth chapter is called Fighting the Church. And all these things tell me and tell you something about my testimony and something about how I think the Spirit has been at work in my life. So the first chapter, which is not true, I was talking today about how the Lord speaks through the imagination, and the Lord seems to speak through my imagination. So this is the imaginative story that captures a real truth about who I am, who I feel that God is, and how I feel that He relates to me. So this is the story that's not true. I'm in school, and I'm sitting towards the back of the class, because I always sat towards the back of the class. You know, just like these guys here want to sit towards the back of the class. And I'm a very quiet boy at school. I never put my hand up to ask a question because I've always been a little bit daydreaming, and maybe the teacher's just given the particular answer to what I'm asking. I'm going to show that I wasn't listening. And I never put up my hand to answer the question because somebody else will. You know, hands go up, why should I put mine up? So I'm a quiet boy, I'm in the class, and one day, Jesus walks into the classroom. I told you it's not a true story. Jesus walks into the classroom, he goes over to the teacher, and he has a little conversation with the teacher, and then he comes out to the middle, and he says, I have a very important job that needs doing. I need to choose somebody who's really responsible, really reliable, and somebody who I can really trust. And I think this situation's got nothing to do with me. And he looks around the class and says, I think I will choose Kelly, because I was always referred to by my second name at school, as all the boys were in our boys' grammar school. I'm choosing Kelly. And I'm just absolutely, totally, and utterly shocked. This person who's coming to the classroom is choosing me to do a very responsible job, and he's going to rely on me and trust me. And I say, Jesus, could you choose somebody else, please? And he says, I could do, but they would be my second choice. Now, that story is not true, but it just captures something about how I feel about myself, how I feel the Lord is, and how I think He relates to me. And maybe He relates to each of us in the same sort of way, in some ways, that He's choosing us for something particular and something specific, and we think He couldn't possibly be me, and the Lord is choosing us. And I think that's... I could relate that to my priesthood, but I think really I'd be doing myself an injustice. I relate that to Jesus calling me to be His friend. Just be His friend, and He wants somebody to rely on. Okay, so that's chapter one. The second chapter is I'm not here on doctor's orders. I'm one of 5 children. Which one am I, do you think? I'm the middle one, I'm number 3. I like to think I'm the most well-balanced, you know, older brother and sister, 2 younger brothers. And my mother, when she was 12 years old, She had a disease called rheumatic fever. Have you ever heard of that? It seems to have died out these days. I don't know whether the doctors have managed to sort of get it under control, but she had rheumatic fever as a child. And this rheumatic fever damages the heart valves, apparently. So her heart always went ba-dum, 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 because some of the blood came back after the first thrust. So her heart was always working overtime. So in her first pregnancy, she was under sort of special measures to make sure that things would be okay. So things were okay. And then she had her second child, and once again under special measures, and she was okay. And then the doctor said, we think it'd be best actually if you don't have any more children. What about me? I was waiting somewhere in line. And the doctors thought things should stop there. And so my mother, due to her commitment to the Lord and her faith, wasn't going to be listening to doctors about how she was going to plan her family. So I'm child number 3, and then child number 4, and child number 5. And we're all perfectly healthy specimens, and we're all making our contribution to the world. So I love to think I'm here against doctor's orders, and it's given me something of a little bit of a rebellious streak about this world that was, you know, somebody was saying, I shouldn't really be here. Now, my mother was always rather poorly, and she died at the age of 56. At the time, I thought she was really old, but I'm 57 now, so I'm thinking, wow. And so she lived a sacrificial life on behalf of her children, and I'm really, really pleased that she did. You know, she's died now, but I can think of my father, who I'll see next week, just as easily as I can think of my mother. And I still feel in relationship with my parents. And the very fact that my mother had a sacrificial life makes me feel a love for her. And I'm sure that she feels a great love for me. And in actual fact, looking back, it wasn't till after she died, when I was 24 years old, that I began to think about priesthood and things began to happen in a different way. So I'm sure from her place with the Lord, she's got much more power and influence over her children than when she was with us. So that's chapter number 2, Hid Against Doctor's Orders. Oh yes, chapter number 3, My First Love. Now, my first love wasn't the Lord. My first love wasn't a person. My first love was the guitar. And I remember coming into school one morning, and a friend of mine brought his new guitar in. And he was in the cloak rooms, whatever we call them, the dressing rooms, and he showed me how to play his first chord of D. If you've ever tried to play the guitar, the first chord you ever learn is D. And you can play half of most praise songs if you can play the chord of D. Add G and A and you're almost there. And when he played that chord and then he changed to another chord, I was completely fascinated. Most people aren't, are they, guitar strums? But I was fascinated by the way the guitar sort of changed its whole personality just by changing your fingers on the string. So I was desperate to have a guitar. And I just loved the guitar. My parents never had to tell me to practice the guitar. They had to tell me to stop practicing the guitar. And there's a great source of analogy there between my love of the guitar and the things of faith. You know, if my parents had wanted me to play the guitar, I'm sure they would have given me a guitar when I was 2 years old. They would have exposed me to lots of guitar music. I would have been taken to guitar concerts. And maybe I would have been put off by the whole thing. But that spark of interest I think, is what everybody needs in their life of faith, where just something in the heart comes alive, and then you want more and more. So I played the guitar for years and years, and going through university, I spent more time messing around with my guitar and amplifiers and electric guitars and messing around with bands than I did in any sort of study. And on leaving university, I felt, well, there's not much I really want to do, really. It was as if the end of the final term of university came as a surprise. And, oh, for the first time in 15 years, there's no next term. What do you do now? There was no job I wanted to do. There was nothing that interested me at all, apart from the guitar. So I thought, I need to be a musician. And I heard this expression, frustrated musician. I thought, that's me. I'm a frustrated musician. I wasn't brilliant, really, but it was just my interest. Many people were far better at playing the guitar, but they didn't have my dedication to it. They had more gift, but less commitment. And so I spent 1 or 2 years messing around in bands, and I was the guitarist in the band, and for a couple of years we played clubs, sometimes a bit like this one. Nobody was really listening to us. We were making a din in the corner, and I think, looking back, you know, who wanted to be in the same room as us making this din, playing this the sort of cover songs? And these bands don't last very long, because you can imagine the relationships in the band, they're not very strong, are they? You know, people just wanting to sort of do their own thing, and people wanting to be successful. Everybody blames everybody else. Everybody comes and goes. So it's absolute chaos, really. And for every famous band, there's a million bands who nothing ever happens. So the most important day of my life, I'm sort of beginning to get there, really, because when you're trying to be a musician, it normally means that you're unemployed. And where was I going when I was unemployed? Back to my parents and living in my parents' house. So I'm there when I'm 22, I'm there when I'm 23, I'm there when I'm 24. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know. But I wasn't thinking, oh my God, God didn't enter into the picture. I was just thinking, this can't go on. And so the most important day of my life, I can't remember what day of the week it was. I can't remember the date. I can't even remember the year exactly, because I didn't know it was important at the time. It was only looking back I could see that was the most important day. And I was sitting in front of the television one evening. It was probably like a Tuesday or a Wednesday evening, because that's when prayer groups happen. Tuesday or Wednesday. And my father said to me, would you like to come to the prayer group to play your guitar? And looking back, I think the angels must have held their breath at that moment. Because if I wasn't going to respond to an invitation to play the guitar, and I wasn't going to respond to an invitation from my father, who'd done everything for me and who I owed so much, what would I have responded to? I dread to think. If I'd said no that night, I think it could have been the end of my salvation history. But there must have been a shred of goodwill within me. And I was only being asked to go and play the guitar. I had no idea what a prayer group was. I'd not been to church since I was 18. I went to university and thought, that's it now, away from authority, away from church, away from everything I don't like. So I go to this prayer group, and it was a little bit like this, really. It was like people sitting in a circle. And because I had the guitar, everybody seemed to be looking at me as if I was some sort of focus of attention. Anyway, I didn't know the song. I just strummed the chords, and my father sort of led the singing. And at the end of it, everyone said, it was absolutely fantastic to have some music here tonight. Please come again next week. So the sense of obligation began to kick in. And there I was, playing the guitar in the prayer group. And At first, I thought these people were a bit crazy. Because two reasons, really. One reason is they were talking about their weaknesses. And the sorts of people I associated with, nobody had any weaknesses. Nobody had any problems. We were all getting on with life, and we didn't express anything about our inner sort of lives or our families. Or these people were talking about difficulties in the families, and I was a bit sort of shocked, really, that they were becoming a bit vulnerable to each other. But I did notice that when people talked about the difficulties, I had a little bit of love for them. You know, somebody said they were very lonely and, you know, they were at home and nobody visited them and this, that, so I began to feel, oh, you know, I just feel a little bit of a desire to love them a little bit more. I didn't realise these things at the time, it's just looking back, really. And secondly, people were then speaking to God. Now, my father was a Catholic headmaster in the local Catholic school. And my mother was a very devotional Catholic and involved in the life of the parish very deeply. But I didn't hear them pray. I didn't hear them talk about their dependence on God. And when I look back, or when I see parents relating to their children now, that it seems to be a much more friendly way of relating. My sort of, you know, just a generation back, parents were more parents and children were more children. And we weren't consulted about things that happened in the family. We were, and so we didn't really know about, you know, the need for God within the family. So that was something that touched me, people being vulnerable and then expressing that need to the Lord. And then people also said, I think the Lord's been asking me to do this. And I think the Lord's been asking me to do the other. And I thought that was all a bit crazy. Because I didn't know the Lord spoke to people. I didn't know the Lord had an intimate relationship with people. I thought we sort of just decided things ourselves. And so that was a bit of a fascination for me. Sometimes this murmuring of tongues would develop. And first of all, I thought they were speaking Latin because it was some sounds I didn't understand. But then, you know, people began to tell me this was the gift of tongues. And okay, you know, gift of tongues. You know. And it, everything was just different from the normal ways of relating and the normal ways of life. And so I continued to go to that prayer group. And then I began to realize that maybe I wanted to be a Christian. Maybe I want to be a Christian. But almost immediately I thought, priesthood. And I thought, no, I want to be a Christian like the other members of this group. I want to be happy and praying. I want to be a Christian, but don't want to be a priest. So what I didn't realise was, the Lord calls us to follow him in the way that he decides. And he did with me anyway. I don't know how much choice he gives you about your lives. But he said to me, if you want to be a Christian, it means you be a priest. That's what it means for you. And I thought it was a bit unfair at the time. But he worked on me. He worked on my heart. And he created a desire, a real strong desire to be a priest. And, you know, I think that's the best good news, that the Lord never asks us to do anything that we don't want to do. He never asks us to do anything that we don't want to do. He converts our hearts so we begin to want to do what he wants us to do. That's great, isn't it? Makes the Christian life really easy. And Jesus says, come to me, all you are overburdened. And I will give you rest, because my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And that's what I find about the life that the Lord has called me to. It's something I could never, ever have dreamed of. The boy at the back of the classroom, the boy who didn't want to be involved, the boy who didn't want to open his mouth. And the Lord says, I think I'll call that one. And I think the Lord likes a challenge, doesn't he? He likes to call the weak to confound the strong and the foolish to confound the wise and all the rest of it. So, the most important day of my life was that rather ordinary day when my father gave me just a very ordinary invitation to come to the prayer group. My final chapter is called Fighting the Church. I went around various religious orders and I was looking for something I could relate to with this newfound fervour that I had. And I went to these various religious orders and I thought, I don't want to be part of those. I don't want to be part of those. So I thought, I think the Lord's calling me to be a diocesan priest. I thought, when you're a diocesan priest, at least you can have your own parish and sort of do your own thing and express your own spirituality. So I applied for the Diocese of Salford, which is where I live. It's Manchester, really, but there's an Anglican bishop of Manchester, so the Catholics very politely call the bishop of Salford, which is just next door. So there's no bishop of Manchester, no diocese of Manchester, only a diocese of Salford. And I went through all these selection interviews, 8 interviews altogether, 4 priests and 4 lay people. And they asked me absolutely everything about my life and relationships and this, that and the other. And at the end of it, the vocations director contacted me and said, the bishop doesn't want to make a decision about you at the moment. Oh, I got the message. And he said, he wants you to rediscover your vocation. I thought, what, rediscover my vocation? I was 28 now. And been unemployed for a number of years. It's about time I started doing something. So, not to be beaten by the church, because someone said to me, if the Lord's calling you to be a priest, he's not going to let any bishop get in the way. So I went to the next diocese. I applied to the next diocese. And the Archbishop of Liverpool, he took me on, and not as a priest, just as a, he said, well, you can live in a parish in the diocese. He gave me that opportunity, and we can take a look at you, and you can take a look at us. So the next year, I went to seminary. And because I'd gone from one diocese to another diocese, there was a big question mark over this guy's head, you know what I mean? Maybe there's something not quite right with him. So I think they wanted to give me a test. So in England, at the time of the Reformation, it was illegal to train priests in England. So various colleges were established in France and Spain and Portugal. And those sorts of foundations are still there. The one in Spain is still there. And it's just a house, and then you go for all your lectures in Spanish. And the bishop said to me, I'd like you to go to Spain. So I said, okay. So at the age of 30, I think I was 31 by the time I got to seminary, I arrive in Spain, I do a 6-week intensive Spanish course, and then it's into classes in Spanish. I couldn't understand a word, of course. They said, write down any sort of sounds or words or phrases that you hear. I came home with nothing. Another lads in the seminary were coming home with a whole A4 or 2 sheets of A4 filled with words and phrases that they'd heard. So I began to think, I don't think I'm very good at this foreign language business. And they said, don't worry, when you come back after Christmas, you'll find things have changed. Well, I came back after Christmas, nothing had changed for me. They said, well, actually, it's in the first year, you don't understand very much. It's in the second year, you begin to understand. So I came back after the next summer, didn't understand anything. I wanted to tell my bishop that I wanted to move seminary, but when you're on your second bishop in your second seminary, you think, well, I better keep quiet. So I stayed in that seminary all that year, for a second year. I was going to tell my bishop when I got home that I don't think things were working out. And he was sick all summer, so I couldn't see him. So I was back in my third year in Spain. And it was ridiculous. I mean, as far as I can see, it was ridiculous. There were traditions of English notes. Some of the lecturers always gave the same questions at the end of term. I used to pass on the resits where they'd give the same questions. Some of the profs just passed the English because, you know, might as well just pass them because there's no point in failing them. And I did 4 years there. And I didn't understand a word of the class. And nobody believed me. That was the worst thing. They thought I was trying to get out of the place by saying I didn't understand, but I didn't understand. So I'm coming up to my diaconate. And I'm thinking, once you're a deacon, you're in holy orders, you're beginning to take some responsibility for the other students in the house. And I thought, well, I've lived a ridiculous life, but I wouldn't recommend it to anybody else. And I thought, I cannot be a deacon in this college. So I went down to the rector and said, I'm sorry, but I can't be ordained. Well, they said, well, we're sorry, we can't recommend you move seminary at this stage of your formation. So, well, I said, it's not something that I've just come up with. This is something that you know has been a struggle for me for 4 years and nobody's done anything about it. And so that's the situation we've got to. And if my bishop wants to kick me out of the system, that's the way it's got to be. It was a really important spiritual moment in my life because I was holding on to my vocation like that. It was the only thing I'd ever had that I really wanted, and was holding on to it, and I had to leave go. I had to leave go even of my sense of vocation, because the Bishop of Liverpool might have said, look, you're nothing but trouble. You can't settle in any situation. I think priesthood's not for you. So I went home with bated breath. He sort of told me off for putting conditions on my ordination, and then he sent me to another seminary. So for the final year of seminary, I was in an English place, and I was doing a degree in the Spanish seminary, but the second English seminary wasn't a pontifical seminary, so I just did a few courses here. And then I was sent back to a parish. I had no ministry and no academic qualification. So in a sense, after 5 years, I was back where I was in the first place, just living in a parish. Anyway, that year things unfolded. They ordained me a deacon, they ordained me a priest, and I'm a priest for about 18 months, and then my bishop dies, and the bishop from Salford comes over to Liverpool. So he's got me back again. Now, meantime, during the summers, I'd gone to the Zion Community summer camps because being in Renewal, I knew people who were involved in that community and I enjoyed going to their summer camps. I related to the spirituality. And Father Pat Lynch, he's the founder of Zion Community 25 years ago. He had a great missionary desire. He said to me, why don't you come and work with me? Yeah. And I said, well, the bishop probably won't let me, that's why not. But he was a rather strong character. In fact, I was saying to Monica, Bishop Julian reminds me a little bit of Father Pat Lynch. When he's got his mind set on something, he does it. And he came to see my bishop. And he said, you know, Father Jared's been working with us on our summer camps. I think, you know, he's got the charism for our sort of work. You know, would you consider releasing him to work with us? So Bishop Kelly, he's this bishop who once rejected me, who now have me back, he said, yes, if this is what he wants to do, he can go. So isn't it amazing how God's providence works? You know, the Lord closes one door because he wants to open another door. He opens one door because he wants us to go through to a different place. And all these things I couldn't see at the time. But looking back, it was just amazing how the Lord sort of, you know, shifted me around to different places so I could work with the Zion Community. When I came to Zion Community, Monica was already there. Monica can remember my introducing myself to the community. And so I was giving my sort of witness and my testimony. And I said, I feel as though I've come home. And my voice started to sort of crack up, you know, because I didn't feel that, you know, my life up to that point had been a preparation for working with Zion Community. And I've been so happy working with Zion Community. There's all the difficulties of life that are in any particular situation, but I've always been really happy doing this work of mission and trying to bring to Catholics who had my first experience of the Catholic faith, which was obligational and somehow a little bit impersonal, to a more spirit-filled faith that originates in the heart and is carried along by desire. And I found it's a really difficult job. Because everybody's decided what they think the Catholic faith is. I suppose I've decided what I think the Catholic faith is. And it's very hard to change somebody else once they've made their mind up. And the Catholic parishes are full of people who've made their mind up. So it's really hard to try and convince them or to show them that there's a different way of doing things. But it's my ongoing sense of vocation that I always have enthusiasm for the next mission. And on the first Sunday, I'm trying to think of a sermon that's going to move them and think of a new idea. Or, you know, shall I sort of stand right out at the front and be really, you know, upfront with everybody about what we're doing? Or should I be sort of more gentle and say, you know, we've just come to help you? And I've tried everything. Nothing works, actually. But I still love the challenge of it. And I'm sure I can only love the challenge because the Holy Spirit is working in that part of my life and motivating and moving me on. And so looking back, did I ever think I'd be going to Australia to speak about the gospel? So, you know, even as I stand here, I'm in the middle of a big surprise. And, you know, I once read a book called The God of Surprises. I don't know if you've read it, but it really spoke to me. And that's the Lord I know, the God of Surprises. And whatever he's doing in our lives at the moment, well, he could be doing something else tomorrow. So we have to be prepared. So that's my book. That's all five chapters now. Thank you.
That was Father Gerard Kelly with The God of Surprises. The Fifth Credo Colloquium was organised by Sydney's Catholic Renewal and Evangelisation Diocesan Office and held at the Catholic Centre in Lidcombe. Credo.org.au